You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Chris Stone. I'm the president of the Open Society Foundations and one of the very last members of the Focal Fan Club of New York City. This is a great opportunity for many of us who have known and worked with our colleagues in Haiti to share an afternoon of a conversation and discussion and debate, I trust, about a range of issues in Haiti, and to bring those conversations here into the offices of the Open Society Foundations in New York and indeed into the city and this country more generally. I wanted to just take a minute to say something just personally about the work in Haiti. My own connection with Haiti goes back to the period between the dictatorship the period of the coup, the sort of period from 86 to 91. When many friends of mine were engaged in a large conversation about rebuilding a justice system in Haiti. And I'm delighted that we have, I think, what will be a very interesting panel discussion today on the questions of justice in Haiti. They have been central to the lessons of my own thinking about how one thinks about justice, conceives justice, and works for institutional reform in some of the most complex contexts. The theme of complexity, I think, is one we should hold on to today. One of you said in the hallway outside, it's so nice to be here for a non-simplistic conversation about Haiti, and I hope today's program will meet that test. We will be, I think, deep in complexity and disagreement and different perspectives throughout the day. And I think if we can meet that test, we will have succeeded. The program is really an opportunity also for many of us to engage with our colleagues at Focal, the foundation that's a part of the Open Society Foundation's family in Haiti. Focal has been in operation since 1995. Ari Nair is here and has told me the stories of the creation of that foundation and the original connections both that he and George Soros made with our colleagues in Haiti. And I think we all owe them a debt for the creation of a foundation that has established itself in really a singular position in the island. Today, Focal is recognized as a strong Haitian institution, respected for its management, its capacity to take on complex and controversial subjects from an ethical standpoint and contribute to the islands and to the country's greatest challenges, whether it's the relations and the issues of citizenship in the Dominican Republic, whether it is the management of one of the most beautiful and complicated national parks probably in the hemisphere. It is an extraordinary institution able to handle this wide variety of topics. The work that I was, Michelle gave me a chance to see several months ago in Montfaucon Park and the opportunity to talk with some of the staff of that park, with some of the young people using the library in the foundation's headquarters to make use of the theater on the ground floor of those headquarters, which at least at the time I think we may have been one of the only, maybe the only standing performance space that wasn't also doubling as a bar or a restaurant in Port-au-Prince. On issue after issue, on topic after topic, as a resource in so many ways to the citizens of Port-au-Prince and to Haiti, Focal has really distinguished itself and remains, I think, has built to be a quite strong, impressive organization. There aren't a lot of such organizations in any city, in any country, and certainly the challenges of building a robust, well-managed, ethical institution in Port-au-Prince are many. And I'm just in awe of what Lorraine, Michelle, all of our colleagues there have accomplished. Focal has not just received support from George Soros and the Open Society Foundations, but has received substantial support from the European Union, from the Qatar Foundation, even from the Smithsonian. I think that ability to attract donors from all over the world is again a singular success feature of Focal, in which we all take pride. It's a great pleasure to introduce Lorraine, or hand over to Lorraine, who's going to introduce the rest of this program. But let me just say a personal word of thanks to all of you for what you do and for all that you're doing for Open Society in Haiti.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's quite wonderful to be here with colleagues, with former members of our board, with current members of our board, with friends and colleagues from New York. I think it's quite an exciting moment of change, both in the world and in the OSF network. We are here to talk to you about the complexity of the situation in Haiti. We are very much seeking questions and interactions with you, so please do not hesitate. We are here to mostly tell you about two aspects of what has informed our theoretical framework for action at the Foundation in Haiti. One of them, history, and we're extremely honored to have Professor Ron Dubois here with us. And the other one is the dictatorship, the Duvalier dictatorship, the crippling effect it has had on the country, and the current struggle, which is tenuous but extremely precious for us, against Duvalier, baby dog having returned to the country, probably hoping to be welcomed and to be able to recuperate his funds that are frozen in Switzerland. Fortunately, a very brave group has attacked him in justice, and this is an initiative that we're still supporting today. We are very proud of them. They will speak to you in the second part. Now, I'm extremely pleased to introduce Michelle Thierry, who is the founder of Focal, the founding executive director and current president. And she's going to introduce President Dubois.
Yeah, thank you, Lorraine, and thank you, Chris, for these nice introductory words. Again, we are extremely grateful to the OSF president, Chris Stone, who is giving us the opportunity to make our country and our foundation be known from a different standpoint, a different perspective. Although still very much linked to the fundamentals of the open society and indeed to the concept of democracy. Two main subjects give coherence to our program this afternoon, just like Lorraine just said. One, the idea that fundamental human rights in their universal understanding were at the core of the Haitian Revolution 2 centuries ago, and that it is where, in that revolution, that their meaning were revealed to the world in a moment of epiphany, like one historian said, where slaves shock the world by stealing their human qualities and their humanity, as being capable of understanding the great ideas and values of the Enlightenment, liberty, justice, equality. And this is what Professor Dubois is going to talk about mostly. Second, our radical position, our radical stand against arbitrary rule, which explains our interest and our position vis-à-vis the Duvalier case, seen as the antithesis of the open society values and understanding. And this is what Michelle Mondas is going to talk about with her friends, our chair, our board chair, Daniel Maguire, and our lawyer and friends, and who was my minister when I was prime minister, was the Minister of Justice. So these two poles of reflections have inspired our vision at the foundation, our conceptual framework, and our strategies since the foundation was created, thanks to the former president of the Open Society, Ari Nair, whom I'm very glad to see here in the crowd. Thank you, Ari, for coming. I know how busy you are. Yes, I think Ari needs an applause. He is the one who, 18 years ago, chose me as being the founder and the first executive director of the foundation, which I started with Lorraine, as you all know. So these two poles of thinking, as I was saying, have inspired our vision, our conceptual framework, our strategies since 1995 until today. They are at the core of our programs and our actions in very adverse conditions and in a very complex situation. So this is really a great opportunity for us to be here and to listen to Professor Dubois, whom I'm going to introduce to you. I had the privilege to meet Laurent when he invited me in April of this year to a conference that he organized with some of his colleagues at Duke University. And I had read his books already, but I had not met him. And since then, we've been trying to collaborate on different issues with regard to history. So let me introduce him to you today. Laurent Dubois is the Marcelo Lotti Professor of Roman Studies and History and the Director of the Forum for Scholars and Publics at Duke University. From 2010 to 2013, he was the co-director of the Haiti Lab of the Franklin Humanities Institute. He is the author of 5 books, including A Colony of Citizens, Revolution and Slave Emancipation in the French Caribbean, 1787-1804, which was published in 2004, which won 4 book prizes, including the Frederick Douglass Prize. His books, Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution, 2004, was selected as the best book of the year by the Los Angeles Times and has been published in translation in Haiti by the Presse Universitaire de l'Université d'État d'Haïti. He has also written about the politics of soccer, with Soccer Empire, the World Cup, and the Future of France, published in 2010, and as the founding editor of the Soccer Politics blog. His most recent book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, published in 2012, which was selected as one of the 100 notable books of the year by the New York Times. His current research focuses on the history of the banjo as an Afro-Atlantic instrument. That's interesting. You know, yesterday, I gave a conference at the French Institute in Haiti about the popular and the tradition of popular music in Haiti. and I'm waiting for your book so that I will be capable of telling the audience where the Benjo comes from and how do we find him in the Haitian rural area. Interesting. The Benjo. And for that, Laurent has received a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Humanities Fellowship, and a Mellon New Directions Fellowship to support this work, which is under contract with Harvard University Press. He has also co-edited several collections, including Slave Revolution in the Caribbean, 1787-1804, Origins of the Black Atlantic, 2009, and the Catalogue for the Revolution. I think Regine Bouzier is here. She's the one who really is trying to see if we can bring that exhibit in Haiti, Revolutions, an exhibit at the New York Historical Society, for which Professor Dubois was co-chair of the Scholars Committee. He recently co-edited a special issue of Transition on New Narratives for Haiti, and is also currently co-editing the Haiti Reader for Duke University Press. Professor Dubois' conference today is entitled Democracy at the Roots, the History of Haiti's Political Culture. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to our guest.
Well, thank you so much for having me here today. It's really an honor to be with you and to speak and to be here for this important event. I was recently able to visit Focal and the Martissant Park just last week during the Haitian Studies Association meeting in Beauplas, and it was really marvelous. Thank you, Lucy, for showing us that. This project left me inspired and dreaming of all the possibilities that can be realized there, and I want to congratulate all the work that's gone into that. I share with Michel Piarouille and many others, of course, the deep conviction that only through a sustained engagement with Haiti's history can we develop approaches suited to the present and nourishing of the right futures. Engaging with Haiti historically, I believe, is the key to understanding the layered practices, structures, and discourses that shape its realities. While that is true, of course, for any society, it seems to me particularly urgent and necessary because of the constant ways in which Haiti is misrepresented, simplified, and misunderstood. So today I'll be taking some time to draw on the basic arguments of my book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, to think about some of the ways Haitian history allows us to encounter the present and possibly rewrite the future. Now, Michel Rolfe Trio has passed away a few years ago, sadly, brilliantly showed in his work, Silencing the Past, that Haiti's emergence on the global stage in 1804 represented a profound challenge, not only to the reigning political order of the day, but also to the various structures of thought that dominated, and in many ways still dominate, understandings of world history. Enslaved people, who were considered chattel rather than human beings, successfully insisted first that they had the right to be free, and then ultimately that they had the right to govern themselves according to a new set of principles. These actions were a signal and transformative moment in the political history of the world. The Haitian revolutionaries, as Michel said, propelled the Enlightenment principles of universalism forward in unexpected ways by insisting on the self-evident but also largely denied truth that no one should be a slave. And they did so at the heart of the world's economic system, turning the most profitable colony in the world into an independent nation founded on the refusal of the system that dominated all the societies that surrounded it in the Americas. Now, these events were the foundation upon which all of Haiti's subsequent history were built. The conflicts and aspirations born of the revolution have shaped and defined the entire political history of the country. Of course, there's never been stasis, and each generation of Haitians have remade history in changing economic, environmental, and global political contexts up to the present day. Yet in many ways, the basic problems posed by the revolution are still there in all these struggles. I found the most useful way to think about this in Haiti and other nations born in revolution, such as the US or France, is perhaps in fact by taking inspiration from one of the key literary engagements with history in Haiti, and that is the work of the spiralist fathers, including Fonquetin and Funoubi. The spiral, as Kaima Glover has written in her recent book, Haiti Unbound, is a sign and symbol of repetition with a difference. Right? Things kind of spiral around and repeat. And this is how we might see the presence of the Haitian Revolution in Haiti, as an event that has haunted and spurred forward different generations, as an event whose conflicts and contradictions have been replayed, though never in precisely the same way, during the past 200 years. Now, approaching this history means not only understanding the particular events, but even more, understanding the long-term sedimentation of structures of perception and thought and action. Our means of access to history has to be multiple and open, for a history of Haiti told only through traditionally written sources inevitably limits and even distorts that history. And I think we also have to think about the many ways in which history can and should be told. One of the projects we carried out at the Haiti Laboratory at Duke University, which I'll talk about today, was the collaborative creation of an artwork called Haiti, History Embedded in Amber, just here on the screen. We worked with the artist Edouard Duval-Carrier, a group of 2,000 faculty, students, and visitors, to create this art installation, which is about as big as this wall on a wall now at Duke University, and a permanent installation. So it's once a memorial and evocation of the earthquake and recent history in Haiti, but also more broadly presents a narration of the many layers of Haitian history. Each one of these blocks is made out of many layers of resin. So I'll be showing some of the parts of this piece today as I speak, because this kind of dialogue between history and the visual, I think, is a crucial one. So what I'm going to do today is just talk briefly about what I see as three crucial legacies or influences of the Haitian Revolution, and how we can think about the event and its long-term impacts. The first is, of course, an important one, which is the largely hostile reaction to the revolution outside the country, which has shaped and continues to shape discourses about Haiti. The second is the formation of political structures through that revolution, right? What's the long-term history of political structures in Haiti as a result of that revolution? And then the third, which in many ways I think is the most important, perhaps, is the creation of a powerful set of cultural, social, and economic structures that Haitian scholar Jean Casimir has dubbed the counterplantation system. Which I see as really a kind of defining force in Haitian history, and probably the most radical production and most important production of that revolution. Now, each of these is not a simple current. There's currents and countercurrents within it. And I'll be trying to call attention to the ways that certain of these legacies, what parts of these legacies, I mean, should be sustained, seem to be the most valuable and worth comprehending and nourishing within the structures of the construction of new Haitian futures. As I've already said, the Haitian Revolution posed a profound threat to the world order as it was. Obviously, the history of revolt to slavery was as old as slavery itself, and though marooned communities in several Caribbean societies had secured their freedom, the scale of success in Haiti was simply stunning and transformative. Jean Casimir, in fact, sometimes describes Haiti as an entire nation of maroons, and that's one way of getting at the radical threat posed by the country. It changed the terms of the debate around slavery all over the world, and it also changed the terms of the imagination of what was possible. It was, of course, an inspiration and an example to the enslaved, carried throughout the Atlantic world in news, songs, and performance. It was a powerful example in part because it was based in important ways on alliances between the enslaved and radical whites who embraced the revolution. And that possibility of alliance was one of the particularly threatening things about it. That aspect of the period is often overlooked in favor of some of easier and racial readings of the revolution. But in fact, understanding the Haitian Revolution chiefly through the lens of race, I think, limits and circumscribes its true political and ideological meaning. Now, the reaction among power holders in the world was, unsurprisingly, very hostile, right? They were mostly deeply invested in the maintenance of slavery. Jefferson was only among many who clearly articulated a desire for containment of what he called the cannibals of the terrible republic. He put in place a policy of diplomatic non-recognition that would last until 1862. The U.S. was the last country in the world to recognize Haitian independence. And of course, as is well known, France only acknowledged Haiti's independence in 1825 in return for the payment of a large indemnity. The indemnity and the interest taken out on the interest on the loans taken out to pay for it sat the Haitian treasury for nearly a century. But as important are the profound intellectual and discursive legacies of this reaction, which began a long history of condescending and willfully distorted portrayals of the country. There is, I would argue, in fact, no country on earth that has been kind of dealt with the same kind of obsessive critique and negation that has been directed at Haiti for the last two centuries. This discourse is a kind of labyrinth, taking many forms, some of them quite easy to identify and undo, others, I think, more insidious. Racism and racialist readings of Haitian history, which have also, it should be said, often shaped historical narratives within the country, are a part of this legacy. These representations, of course, shifted over time. They were reconfigured and reactivated at different moments, particularly during the U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which produced a kind of explosion of new representations of Haiti that really continue to shape our imaginary in this country. Scholars have studied and confronted these representations in increasingly rich and careful ways, and this is critical. The only way to begin to emancipate ourselves from these visions is to study the enemy carefully. This is often a difficult task, though, because I would argue even certain kinds of representations, these representations often infuse even the best meaning in depictions of the country. Now, there always were countercurrents to this history, notably within African-American traditions of thought within the United States, which presented alternative visions of Haiti. Intellectuals, anti-slavery activists, and artists persistently offered alternative visions. Indeed, large groups of African Americans emigrated to Haiti in the 1820s and 1861. One institutional effect of this, of course, was James Theodore Holly, an African American who founded Haiti's Episcopal Church. I'll just give one example of this broader matrix that has a lot of personal meaning to me because it's in Durham, North Carolina. In Durham itself, there's a neighborhood called Haiti. It's where North Carolina Central University, which is HBCU, is located. This is actually a map drawn of Durham in the 1870s, and if you can see, there's a little tiny community called Haiti right there in the center. A little difficult to see. So this neighborhood eventually became a kind of central neighborhood of African American Durham, and in the center of this neighborhood was an AME church, St. Joseph's AME Church. On top of this, on the steeple, is this. Which some of you may recognize as being a surprising thing to be on top of the Protestant AME church. But it is quite clearly a veve to El Jouy, right? How it got there is still a bit of a mystery. We're working on figuring that out. But it probably arrived sometime in the 1920s as the result of connections between African Americans and the AME church, of course, had a long history in Haiti going back to the 1820s. In fact, Jean-Pierre Smiles' ancestors were practicing AME and so forth. So I'm kind of reminded of the undercurrent of connection between the United States and Haiti every day as I drive past this on the way to the airport and so forth. In the project we made one block with Eduardo Ali and I, kind of devoting this, called As We Use in Durham. And you can see here we kind of tried to bring that back into its original context. This painting here, many of you probably are familiar with it, it's Eduardo Ali's painting of As We being arrested by the Coast Guard trying to get into the United States. So our suggestion of the block was that she can't really stop because she's actually already been in the U.S. for quite some time. Okay. The second legacies of the Haitian Revolution are the country's political institutions and practices, right? And that's something many historians have for a long time thought about. It's critical to understand that this early history of Haiti's political institutions were shaped by the broader context of hostility. You can say that Haiti's early leaders were paranoid, but they had every reason to be so. After all, everyone really was pretty much out to get them. The new nation's political culture was deeply shaped by the idea that freedom was fragile, and that both old and new enemies might well attempt to reestablish slavery. And again, this was a quite reasonable fear, just sustained by the actions of the French and the U.S. and so forth. The refusal of diplomatic recognition by France and the United States, the widespread racist representations of the country and its revolution, were constant reminders of this threat. And in the early years after the revolution, right, the French Ferrand and others were literally in the DR fighting. So this was, again, it wasn't an imaginary process. The French were actually capturing children along the border and enslaving them. So all this was quite real. Now the question for them was how to best protect the country and solidify its autonomy, right, a very serious problem. This problem was, of course, really first confronted by Toussaint Louverture himself during the revolution, and the solutions he developed were maintained by post-independence Haitian leaders, including Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Henri Christophe, and Jean-Pierre Bouilly. We tried to represent this in this work of art through a series of blocks. This was actually made by Julia Caffield, who was the student who found this Declaration of Independence that is exposed out there. So she incorporated some of the language of the Declaration of Independence into this document. Then there are a series of blocks that kind of meditated on this history of Haiti's early leaders. Eduardo Duvalier's piece called The Burnt Hero of Toussaint Louverture as the kind of key to Haitian history. This one we did that kind of reconfigured the Savoir des Ancêtres, a very famous depiction of early Haitian independence that showed kind of unity between Dessalines and Pétion, a unity which was, of course, kind of short-lived. And then this meditation by a student about the kind of long presence of militarism in history. Now, the strategy of Haiti's early leaders was to try to establish a secure foundation for self-defense and economic autonomy by maintaining the plantation economy, right? So that was their decision, essentially, was that only the plantation economy, although founded by slavery, only the plantation economy could be the foundation for continuing autonomy. They believed that only the production and sale of the plantation commodities of sugar, but especially coffee, could they maintain the army, build forts, foster alliances with foreign powers that would keep Haiti safe. So to the Haitian people, the leaders offered this deal. In order to be preserved, freedom had to be circumscribed. Right? What that meant concretely was that they insisted that most of the population should continue working on plantations, despite being free. The working conditions were clearly an improvement from those of slavery, and that's made clear by the fact that people rose up against the French, against the reestablishment of slavery. It's not the same thing. But they also fell far short of the kind of freedom and autonomy most of the formerly enslaved actually envisioned for themselves. Leaders beginning with Louverture ultimately responded to the resistance among the population with various forms of coercion, often violent, and they developed a militarized and autocratic set of institutions that they justified as being necessary for the protection and preservation of Haiti's independence. The most famous symbol of this approach, of course, is the Citadelle Lafayette, built by Henri Christophe, a vast fortress visible from miles away, meant to withstand a new invasion by the French, and just as much to stand as a symbol of the determination of Haitians to remain free. Some of the stones used to build this fortress were literally carried from old plantations and sugar works from the plain below by former slaves, rounded up to do the work under conditions some contemporaries described as brutal and even as a new kind of slavery. So you can kind of see, obviously, the contradiction. I'm trying to suggest we need to understand this in complex terms, these kind of decisions they made. Now, Robert Fountain Jr. and others have argued that these early styles of governance laid the foundations for a long-term tendency in Haiti towards regimes constructed around militarism. Almost all 19th century presidents were generals, and political exclusion of various types. And there is no doubt an important truth to this argument, and understanding and interrogating the forms of Haitian authoritarianism is critical. But there is also another political history of Haiti that is more complicated than that. Though always under pressure and circumscribed, there was a long tradition of Haitian parliamentary activism, parliamentarianism, going back to the Pétion regime. Even Christophe's regime, I would argue, which is often lampooned because of its construction of a local Haitian aristocracy, can more usefully be seen as a creative attempt to create a kind of coalition government out of a very diverse and fragmented leadership class in the north of Haiti. At many moments in Haiti's history, the parliaments were in fact sites of intense and vivid opposition to authoritarian leaders. This is very clear in the 1840s, when liberal opposition to Boyer, hated among other things for his private and non-consultative signing of the 1825 indemnity with France, found voice in the parliament as well as in Haiti's burgeoning and very active press. The African-born Félix Dafoul wrote passionately and brilliantly against Haiti's colorist political order. A 24-year-old named James Blackhurst, inspired by the ideas of Saint-Simon, created Cooperative Farm in Haiti. And in 1843, the liberal opposition began a mass uprising, one that a British observer described as being unparalleled in history because of the startlingly peaceful way it was carried out. Democracy, another observer wrote at this moment, flowed full to the brim, and what democracy? Now, the 1843 revolution was followed by an even more remarkable mobilization among peasants in the south, led by Ahau, which showcased inventive forms of political discourse and symbolism that grew from grassroots organizing among small farmers. These revolutionary groups eventually came into conflict, and ultimately the reformist hopes of this period were dashed. But we should remember that these democratic forms of mobilization would repeatedly be used in Haiti's political history, were clearly present throughout the 19th century. They came out again in the 1880s when the intellectual and statesman Antonin Firmin pursued a failed bid for presidency, for instance. And they were also critical during the U.S. occupation of Haiti. When Haiti occupied in 1915, there were various forms of opposition. The opposition at first did not come from the elite, but eventually members of parliament did resist the rewriting of the Haitian constitution, prompting the U.S. Marines to shut down and muzzle the Congress in response. More importantly, in some ways, it came in the Capo uprising. So this uprising that started in 1919 against the U.S. Marines, really triggered by the use of corvée labor by the U.S. Marines. This uprising was led by rural elites, people like Shalaman, Mehat, and Bakhaviu, so somewhat wealthy people who had a certain amount of land in the countryside. But their movement was highly democratic in character. They held these large meetings in the countryside to develop strategy. They saw themselves as inheritors of the tradition of the Haitian Revolution, and they organized themselves both militarily and politically in ways that drew on the traditions of those ancestors. Perelt's movement was ultimately crushed by the Marines, this famous image that many of you are familiar with. His body was exposed and photographed by the Marines, and pictures of that photograph distributed among the population in order to kind of announce the death of the leader. But even the story of that image, which was rapidly reappropriated and ultimately became a symbol of remembrance and resistance in Haiti, hints at the powerful ways in which the politics of hope for democracy and autonomy persisted in Haitian communities. And this block shows underneath the original image, and then above it, Cedric Aubin's painting of the death of Bejaz. And around him are actually his document that I found in the Haitian, the U.S. National Archives, which has a series of folders of papers taken from the Capos after they were killed. And among them is this, which is a prayer that was hanging on the neck of Benoit Batfavid when he was fighting the Marines, and that's now in Washington. Now, there are a lot of other examples we could cite, of course, in the 20th century, including the 1946 revolution, as part of this longer democratic tradition. What is all critical to remember here, I think, is that we need to understand something that Jean Dominique, for instance, articulated in a beautiful essay called La Femme Malgache Haïtienne, which is that the grassroots democratic organizing that led to the overthrow of Duvalier in 86, in fact, tapped into a very long and deep tradition of political imagination, practice, and organizing in the country. Right? When we forget that history, we also needlessly let go of a set of powerful precedents and intellectual resources through which we can imagine the future of Haitian democracy, not as something that has to be invented or imported in any way, but rather something that simply needs to be cultivated from within the country's own diverse political traditions. Now, the last part I'll talk about today is the counterplantation system, okay, using Jean Cassinier's formulation. All the oppositional and alternative forms of politics I talked about were, in fact, rooted in a larger cultural and social system. And that system is, I would argue, the most significant and radical product of the Haitian Revolution. Understanding the other legacies of the revolution I've described here is critical to understanding the constraints and pressures placed on Haiti's people from inside and outside. But I would argue that understanding the counterplantation system in its full complexity is ultimately the most critical analytical task before us. For it's out of an engagement with this system we can best think collectively today about what Haiti is and might be. So what is the counterplantation system? This is something that was built by the formerly enslaved starting during the Haitian Revolution. This group was, and it's really critical to remember this, majority African-born in 1804. Right? So the majority of the country had been born and raised in Africa at the time. Many of them had, in fact, been in the colony only a few years by the time the revolution began. Just in terms of statistics, in the years before the revolution, about 40,000 enslaved a year were brought to the colony. So in 1791, there were as many as 100,000 people or more for whom the experience of being enslaved in Saint-Domingue was a tiny little experience between freedom in Africa and then freedom through the revolution. As they created a new order for themselves through this revolution, formerly enslaved in Saint-Domingue, they drew on African forms of politics and agricultural organization, on a variety of family structures. Obviously, the African forms they were drawing on were extremely diverse and complex as well. Spirituality. The example of the Maroon communities in Haiti was an important example. And all the spaces of autonomy that were built within the plantation world even before the revolution. So there are lots of examples for building a new order. A lot of these African individuals were at the forefront of the military and social struggles of the revolutionary period. There's leaders like Makaya and Sanssouci who were African-born. And they made use of what opened up through the revolution to craft a new way of life on the plantations, transforming the plantations into something else. The system, which of course has lots of parallels elsewhere in the Americas, right? It's, in some ways, there are counterplantation systems in all post-emancipation societies in the United States and elsewhere, but nowhere was it pushed as far or achieved so much as in Haiti. It was based not just on dismantling the plantation, but also on setting up structures organized to avoid its return in any form. Right? From the perspective of this majority, a plantation was still a plantation, whether its profits were meant to fend off the French or not, right? So they resisted the kind of leaders interest in the plantations. They generally turned their backs on the plantation-based products of the early political leaders and took the control of the land and put it to their own uses. This was, as I've already said, I think the most radical gesture in the Haitian Revolution, since it actually insisted that only through a complete transformation of the social and economic order could real freedom be attained. So they refused the idea, when advanced by the leaders, that they had to accept serious limits on liberty in order to preserve it. They built their own kind of citadel through a set of social institutions rooted in individual land ownership anchored within broader family and community institutions. And that's important. on the land that they took over, they did all the things that had been denied them under slavery. They built families, freely practiced their religion, worked for themselves, grew food for themselves and for local and regional markets, but also found that coffee, plantation crop, could be successfully grown on small farming, family farms, and bring in money they could use to buy other goods from the towns. So the combination of the kind of production for within and export of coffee actually guaranteed rural Haitians a better life materially and socially than available to pretty much all peoples of African descent in the Americas throughout the 19th century. And over time, despite opposition from certain leaders and the institution of laws meant to save the plantation, rural Haiti was largely transformed into a space divided into small holdings, a space of striking social and political autonomy. And despite many attempts, including those made during the 20-year occupation of Haiti, the attempts to rebuild plantations in Haiti have largely met with failure, which is a striking thing within the Caribbean, where in Cuba and the DR and Puerto Rico, this is done differently. Now, along with Jean Casimir, the greatest analyst of the system was Georges Anglade. We lost him in the earthquake in 2010, and his work brilliantly explores all the layers and complexities of the system, and it is a very complicated system. What he and others have shown is that the counter-plantation system was actually quite viable, producing the coffee exports to sustain Haitian economy in the 19th century, while also providing all the food needed for the country's population. Right? This is not a country that exported, that imported any food. In one sort of simple fact, I think, can summarize the relative success of this system, which is that in the 19th and early 20th century, a time when Europe, for instance, was sending mass waves of migrants looking for fleeing poverty, very few people ever left Haiti. In fact, the country was a magnet for immigration. People came from close as other parts of the Caribbean, including Guadeloupe and Martinique, as well as Europe and the Middle East, and I've already mentioned the African-American migrants. And many of these migrants actually became part of Haiti's rural communities, although others obviously became part of the merchant groups. And so. Now today, as we think about this as historians, we confront a lot of challenges writing the history of the counter-plantation system. Of course, hostile outsiders, as well as many Haitian political leaders, left behind ample archives of their own for us to grapple with. But the rural population of ex-enslaved people in the 19th century, the majority of them African-born, left very few traces, right? But they were the ones who actually created the new Haiti. Right? So how do we write the history of that creation? In fact, oddly enough, it's in many ways easier to write the history of the involvement in the enslaved in the Haitian Revolution, because the French were kept a lot of these archives, than it is to write the history of post-independence rural Haiti. Especially if we limit ourselves to written texts, we end up depending on what one historian called the archives of repression, right? The laws and pronouncements such as the Code Henri or the Code Rural that were meant to contain and reverse the system. There are, though, a lot of other archives that can be used and cultivated in Haiti. The very practices of land tenure, structures of family, the songs of Haitian voodoo that many of us are working on that often reflect on and refer to the cultural construction of this system. The Haitian Creole language itself and its forms of address, proverbs, ways of condensing morality and analysis of power also offers up a rich archive of ways of seeing and being. Interestingly, in our project, it was two undergraduate students who maybe depicted the best this kind of mix of systems, that kind of implementation system. One here that uses the language itself as a kind of symbol, and then this one by a student called The Whole, which was a way of bringing all lots of different elements to kind of create a kind of image of Haitians, including indigenous elements, African elements, and the landscape. I'll conclude. The counter-plantation system has long been, I think, misunderstood as an atavistic form of retreat, as a form of subsistence, for instance, or worse, by many outsiders as well as many Haitian thinkers. In fact, though, that is, I think, the wrong way to think about it. Rather, this is a historically crafted response to a very particular historical experience, that of having successfully destroyed slavery in the plantation and having systematically set about making sure it never returned. It is not a system of escape, but rather a system of engagement that is based on an absolute commitment to maintaining autonomy and dignity as the basis for that engagement with the broader world. It is nourished by a memory, both vivid and realistic, that for a long time, and in many ways still today, many in the world see Haitians as only as either victims or potential laborers at the bottom of the global economic order. The counter-plantation system, then, is a constant refutation of that vision and a cultivation of something else. A different political imagination, one that continues to deeply challenge the world as it is, reminding us that it is not the world as it must be. Thank you. So I'm happy to take questions at the time.
Yes, thank you, Professor Dubois. It's very interesting view. view on the Haitian Revolution, the complexity and the contradictions of this difficult time. And before I open to the floor, I don't know if Dr. Rabinovich is there.
Yes.
He's there. Doctor, I would very much like you to react to Professor Dubois, since you were together in this New York Historical Society's revolution, the Atlantic World Reborn, which
I have some pictures.
You have some pictures. Anyway, thank you for coming. And I give you, I'm very directional in my opening to the floor. So, since we have Dr. Rabinovich with us, and in his New York Historical Society exhibit that took place 2 years ago about the three revolutions, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Haitian Revolution, and the relationship between the three, I think it would be very interesting to have it.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation. Linda Kaplan, my colleague, worked with Laurent and a team of scholars, 22 scholars, including Jean Casimir, on the development of the Revolution exhibition. I have 10 images of it that I hope to show you. It opened at the New York Historical Society almost exactly 2 years ago on 11-11-11. And it ran for about 5 months, and I think we had about 125,000 visitors. The exhibition charged to us the brief that we were given by Louise Mirror, the president of the Historical Society, was to do an exhibition on revolution. But she also had heard Laurent, actually at the event in which he was awarded the Frederick Douglass Prize in 2004-2005. And she was inspired to think that the Haitian Revolution would be an important part of this story, which made it very exciting for me, because the last thing that I wanted to do was yet another exhibition on the American Revolution. I've actually counted, and over the course of my career, I've done 12 of those. So we had the space, and we thought we could create a narrative in which we would look at the three revolutions, at the American, French, and the Haitian Revolution. But I also recognized that, as I said, the American Revolution has been done. The French Revolution was so enormously complicated and such an extraordinary curatorial task. Haitian Revolution, by contrast, is unhappily, sadly unknown, relatively unknown. And in New York, in the metropolitan area where we have 350 or 400,000 Haitians and Haitian Americans, for me it was very important to bring the Haitian Revolution to the center of our work. So in a certain sense, it's really an exhibition about the 18th century age of revolutions, which really points to the Haitian Revolution, as Laurent taught us, as the culmination, as the fulfillment, in a sense, of the promises of those earlier revolutions. In fact, it's an exhibition which really addresses the construction of three major transformations, the revolt against monarchy, the dethroning of kingship in the new United States and in France, the attack against aristocracy and of course the establishment of an attack on slavery. So those three things where we were thinking would all happen together, and the Haitian Revolution became the kind of fulfillment of that. In a certain sense, it meant reminding American visitors that our revolution, the United States Revolution, left in place the largest slave system in the world, and one which continued to grow. There were 750 Africans enslaved in 1790 at the first census, and 4 million in 1860. Since slavery actually, the slave system in the United States was one in which, uniquely in the Western Hemisphere, in which the slave population was actually reproducing. In Saint-Domingue and in what became Haiti, the death toll, the killing fields of the sugar plantations had really kept that population. No matter that 40,000 people a year were being imported, the deaths were still keeping that plantation down. How are we doing on? Anyway, we set out to create this exhibition, and I think, as I said to a number of you, we started to do our research first in American collections. There are great collections at the University of Michigan, the Clements Library, and the John Carter Brown Library, Brown University, the New York Historical Society, the New York Public Library. Linda and I went to France. We worked twice for two periods of a month each at the Archives Nationales and the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, and we went to the Archives the Colonial Records in Aix-en-Provence. And then I took a trip for 10 or 12 days with Jean Casimir. I went to Haiti, and we traveled through the country, and we interviewed people. There are two things that happened, I think, that were of interest to me. One was that I was increasingly distressed that the history of Haiti actually doesn't survive in Haiti, that the documents should be in the United States. The University of Florida has a great collection of materials and so on, and in France, and that there are relatively few, at least so far, collected in public, publicly accessible libraries and archives. The National Archives in Haiti is largely, its collection essentially begins with material from the 1850s. So it doesn't have the story of the revolution. And that was very distressing to me, because I thought a really basic quality of national independence would be the ownership of those documents, and that we wouldn't want to have the only surviving copies of the United States Declaration of Independence in London. I mean, that would not be, or in France. It's, so that was one of the critical issues. The other issue, I think, the other issue is that the North American historians who worked on the project, and even more the French historians, tended to see the revolution in, as a political process. I think what I was learning working with Laurent, and especially when I went to Haiti and I convened groups of scholars and poets, and especially of women, it turned out that there is a male history, masculine perspective on the Haitian Revolution, which emphasizes that it was essentially a military and political context. And what Laurent has just described as the counter-plantation system was, in fact, a process that was generated in large measure, in major significance, by women, and that we had not yet discovered in the literature, and I still think it's failing in the literature, the role of women in the revolution. You know, all of these military heroes, the succession of political leaders, so it's easy to see that the whole revolution essentially was a masculine endeavor. So I'm just going to take you quickly through the show. The first image is introduces the story by giving you the 7 Years' War. This is on the second floor of the New York Historical Society. And then we brought you into a collection of remarkable documents which really represent the colonial sense of confidence in the European empires embodied in this cartography. This is a world of communication. And we wanted to contrast that with the taverns. So we recreated tavern that could have been in any seaport at this point in the little town of New York where we now meet. There were one tavern for every 55 inhabitants of the town. So there's plenty of time when these people were fomenting revolutions. The point of this in the show was to underpin the idea that the revolution didn't just occur by the creation of these magnificent documents that those of you who studied American history were asked to read and study, but it also occurred through the work of the kind of scuttlebutt, the kind of street wisdom, the kind of thing. Particularly, the vision of this story actually came to us through the work of a man who was has been a colleague of Laurent's and is a brilliant historian named Julius Scott, who now is at the University of Michigan. And Julius had written a dissertation at Duke in the 1980s called The Common Wind. And he used that title because that comes from Wordsworth's poem about Toussaint Louverture. And Julius had actually gone into the archives in Madrid and Paris and London and in Germany and discovered evidences of the ways in which African people passed political ideas. And so we no longer have to see this as a trickle-down kind of story. The fomenting of this revolution occurred in the way in which these Africans and revolutionary sailors met in these kinds of taverns. So you could go into these taverns, see these pieces of fragments of gossip as you went through it. Linda had succeeded in convincing the Parliamentary Archives in London to lend us the Stamp Act. This raises a good question for us in light of trying to bring this show. This was a document that was, of course, never been out of London. It's the original scroll on which the Stamp Act was written. The story of its coming to New York, we had come in a first-class seat.
We have to move.
And so here's the beginning of the part of the exhibition about Laurent de Saint-Marie, his vision of Haiti for the revolution, sugar plantations. This is a model of Versailles made out of sugar by a Mexican artist to show that the Versailles, in fact, was a palace constructed on the wealth of sugar. More about that, these great documents, the great painting of Jean-Baptiste Bellet from Versailles. And then an area where we dealt with the La Coup and the counter plantation system with a film that was done with the anthropologist Rachel Beauvoir. And finally bringing the Haitian Declaration of Independence in that little center case. This was the discovery that Julia Gaffney made. And then as you see on the left and the right, the interactive devices that allowed you to read through the documents in English and French and Creole. And actually, all of the exhibit was labeled in French and Creole as well as English, which was something quite different from anything that happened before. Thank you so much.
Any other reaction, question?
Thank you very much. My name is Jean Carmel. I'm from John Jay College of Criminal Justice down the street. And I was fascinated by the account of the counter plantations. And I was just wondering if you could say something about the relationship of the growth of those counter plantations and deforestation and urbanization processes and sort of how they may be connected.
Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously the long-term history there's a conflict between different models. I mean, there's on some level, the counter plantation system has a model of sustainability, right? That actually goes back to the fact that enslaved people on plantations have to usually cultivate tiny plots of land in order to sustain themselves, so kind of intercropping at different levels and all that kind of stuff. So at the same time, of course, over the long term, the demographic pressures and the increasing population meant that there was more and more pressure on smaller plots of land, right? So you have that kind of conflict. There's a lot of variety around how those dealt with in different places. Shouldn't forget that one of the 19th century industries in Haiti was also logging for dyed wood and so forth. So there's like a lot, and earlier than that, there's actually problems with deforestation in Haiti already in the 18th century, because a lot is cut down just to build a plantation system. So, I mean, part of the history of deforestation is a really long durée history. But it strikes, I mean, from my perspective, it does seem like there's a lot within the counter-plantation system that's actually a basis for new kinds of sustainability, in fact. You know, so the problem is sometimes that's seen as the main, the main problem in Haiti is that small farmers are cutting down trees, which is, I think, a distortion of the bigger reality, which isn't to say that there isn't, serious issues in rural Haiti today, obviously. But how you grapple with those seems to me has to be a kind of a response. I mean, something that's related to the cultural history of that.
Good afternoon. And just listening to some of the things that you've stated, I'm just going to make a quick point. If you look at the what you call the counter-plantation, which gave birth to a system of deux moitiés, would that be correct? In which, if you look at what happened in Chile, which is pretty much very similar, where peasants in these areas who did not know how to read had the big landowners, and this is what the problem has been since, a concentration of capital in a lot of places, a concentration of land in Haiti in particular. So therefore, most of the people in the country, especially the large farming, had no rights. They were nothing else but different slaves at a different level. And furthermore, that system of deux moitiés was to cheat them constantly, sometimes waiting for whatever product, if it were sugar canes, waiting for it to dry or to sort of lose weight, and then pretty much what has been done in the Dominican Republic with the Haitians. So there's another point that you just made I think is very, very interesting. Systems that are based on energy of trees are not social systems that are self-sustaining. They are self-destructive. Because in fact, what has given birth to the societies that we now see are societies that came out of an oil-based society, not necessarily very self-sustaining, but have given a tremendous growth to humanity based on that control of energy. Haiti does not have energy. The energy that Haiti has since its inception till today is the individual, which represents in science term as 0.1 energy. A washing machine is 5 times that value. So the society hasn't been transformed. So a destruction that is ongoing is pretty much what we're seeing. So that's the way I live it.
Yeah, I think those are great questions. I think some of this is to say that what we see in the second half of the 20th century is not, what we've always seen in Haiti. So there's obviously a lot, there have been different sediments and periods of this. This is not the case as much in the 19th century. But I also think that many of the sort of situations in the last 50 years have also been propelled forward by certain, there's another discussion to have about why in the last 50 years things have degraded so rapidly and changed so rapidly in the Haitian context. So because you don't see, it wasn't the same in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. So I think the process might have been, in other words, I'm trying to suggest that we don't see the process as an inevitable one, but as one of in some ways, continual choices that are made with regards to Haitian society. The Dabachi thing is not everywhere, right? I mean, it's certainly true that there were landholders, who were big landholders who offered Dabachi. There are other parts of the country where people really basically took over the land and didn't have to negotiate with landholders. And it sort of depends where that was happening. So that food systems that were developed in certain places. So I agree that there are forms of exploitation that went on. The key is that, in the book I just described, I think there's a stalemate that develops between these two models. And the reason for the difficulty is that, of course, there's a refusal of that model on the part of the elites, and there's an advantage taken through tax systems that sap a lot of the resources of the countryside. And you have this basic stalemate that worsens the situation over time, so there's no doubt that that's part of the analysis. But I think we also have to take seriously that system as a historically constituted system that has its own vision of the world and which is there and has to be grappled with in one way or another, which doesn't mean that the systems don't need to change, on both sides, if that makes sense to you. So it's not, in other words, to sort of acknowledge it historically as something that doesn't necessarily mean to say it has to be eternally like that. But it's also, I think, wrong to say that we should just dismiss it. I'm not saying that's what you were saying, but many people have, I think, dismissed it. So.
Moshi. Laurent, I've been always an admirer of your work, and I think what you have brought in the history of Caris, but also the American and French Revolution, is the role Haiti played to put in practice the human rights that was proclaimed, especially at the moment of the French Revolution. But I wonder if one of the problems of the collective memory of Haiti is not that the memory is based on the war, the victory against Napoleon, and then the price, what you describe in your presentation. What is dominating the memory is not that Haiti illuminated the human rights revolution at the moment of the French and the American Revolution more than what has happened in metropolitan or France or America, but that the Haitian survived an attack from the metropolitan France and the Napoleon troops. And I read recently the book of a colleague, Philippe Girard, in French, Ces esclaves qui ont battu Napoléon. The guy has done a very detailed report of all the expedition. And when I finished reading that, I thought that was like a civil war. It was a war between cousins. It was a civil war. And I think we have still a representation of the war as the French versus the Haitian, and not a family divided. Because it is what happened. In fact, it was the family who broke. It was cousin who
it's very controversial what you're saying. Extremely controversial. You know that Philippe Giraud there is a big controversy.
I am putting that on the table.
Because there is another historian, French, Jacques de Gonin, who claimed that Girard invented most of these things are not documented, and that he even
he stole some of
his own stories.
I'm not saying it's true. I'm saying that what he's describing, for example, the fact that you had two sons, I'm not sure that he's invented that there was two sons of two sons, where two and one on one side and on the other side. So that was
a complicated issue, but it was not a civil war.
It was not a war between cousins.
It was a war between the French army and the Swiss understood.
You misunderstood me. Because when I speak about cousin, I speak the cousinage between the French and the Haitian. You misunderstand me, sorry. Yes, what I wanted to say is that as soon as, because of the revolution and through the Haitian action, we were all free, brothers and sisters, during 8 years, between 1794 and 1802. We were citizens. All citizens. In the discourse of the revolution. So the invasion of Napoleon broke this this confraternity that has been.
No. There were big issues at the time. You know that when the enfranchisement came, when the slaves were liberated before the revolution, they didn't even know how to name them. What name are we going to give to the former slaves? Are they French citizens? No. Are they cultivateurs? No. You know how they call them? The Africans. So there were so many difficult issues to deal with, that it was not a matter of French and slaves being in a big fraternity at the time.
There was a potential of human rights illuminated
not a potential. There was the issue of human rights.
Of course,
that the core
that was broken by the invasion of Napoleon. What I heard from this book is that, and I never heard that from the French side, is that how many troops were sent? It was like three expeditions. What I want to say is that when we learned about it in France, it's an expedition. The troops were defeated by sickness, and that's over. It was a very structural. It was the first guerrilla war. I feel when I have read that, it was won by the addition of guerrilla. And so there is a problem. Of in France and in Haiti, of what do you memorize? Do you memorize the war, or do you memorize the identification to the human rights symbolization? Okay.
For both? Yes. Okay. Because we have a very positive memory of history. You know, Haitians have no memory of slavery per se, just like they do in the French Antilles. Because it's far gone. Our memory is the memory of the victory because the troops came to re-establish slavery. That was the purpose of Napoleon's troops. So the fact that we won that victory is what remains in our collective memory. It's a very positive memory of freedom and liberty. Merci.
I mean, I think I'll just say what I think is critical is to understand that from the beginning, during the revolution and on, there was a serious problem, which is how do we save our freedom, right? Vis-a-vis the French, but also internally, what structure we build. And that's simply what I was trying to emphasize, is that the long-term debate within Haiti over what is the best way to preserve freedom, right? I think there's actually a common sense of that freedom has to be preserved, it has to be saved, but that there are different ways of doing that, right? And that's partly. So there is a tension within the revolution, of course, between the leadership and the people who. And the situation in Haiti is very, very complex because of the diversity of perspectives. I think it's very different from the United States in a certain way. You really have people, most of whom are from other countries, right? I mean, this is a revolution carried out by people from all over the continent of Africa. So just the miracle of having been able to unite around a particular project is itself amazing. And the fact that, I mean, I didn't emphasize it enough today, but the fact that these new cultural forms are created partly as a form of unity, right? Language and religion. I mean, all those, I think, are. So in some ways, it's just that there's these resources within Haitian history, all along its history, that allow us to think about the present. I mean, that's, I think, the key. And so that the memory, of course, we can cultivate more sides of the memory, right? And I think especially what I was trying to emphasize, I think the history of sort of 19th century Haiti, for instance, is not, you know, needs to be recalled more than the kind of these different movements that at different times in Haitian history have sought to create democratic possibilities. All that, I think, gets sometimes, I mean, outside and even in some ways inside a little bit overlooked. Because that whole trajectory is important, how a sedimentation and continuation of the struggle. So, anyway. The debate will not end today.
It's complex.
Yes.
We're going to break, and we're hoping that everybody is going to come back after the break, because we're going to talk about the dictatorship and about Duvalier. Vertus?
I would like to say something.
So Vertus is a member. Vertus Saint-Louis, Professor Vertus Saint-Louis, is a member of FOCAS Board of Directors. He's a historian, and we're happy to hear his comments. Before I hand it over to Vertus, I wanted to say that this exhibit, we are hoping to bring. We are hoping to bring an adapted, permanent version of that exhibit to Haiti. Focal is helping a very interesting young institution called the IT Nexus, who's trying to do this. It's not that easy, because I think it needs to be adapted, and also it needs to find a permanent home. But maybe you will hear again about that initiative.
I listen to great attention, Professor Juan. He spoke about the legacies of our evolution. And I think he is very nice. Maybe because he is a foreigner. But personally, I don't have any reason to be nice with our state, with the Asian state. Before the Asian Revolution, I think that Asian Revolution is a revolution for human rights and for rights. Before the revolution, right concerned human beings, and rights concern political institutions. And I insist on political institutions, because the colonial state was a military state, while France was a civil state. The king in France was not a dictator, according to Emile Petit, a French jurist and magistrate. And he told that the state in the colonies was a military state. In France, the intendant, who was a civil servant, had more authority than the governor, the military governor of the place, because the intendant was the representative of the king. When the revolution began in Haiti, the white colonies wanted the conservation of the military state only for the free people of color and for the slaves. And for themselves, they requested a civil government with political autonomy. And when the slaves were the people who understood better the problem of rights, the free people of color said, we must have equality with the white colonies, because we have properties, we are owners, we have business, we are taxpayers. But the slaves understood the French Declaration of Human Rights and Citizenship as something which gave them right to liberty. And some of the Catholic priests who gave support to the uprising, like Father Castro, he said he wanted to be among the slaves to teach them the gospel of freedom and the declaration of right, human rights and citizenship. And when the day Saint-Onax proclaimed that all slaves are free, the first article said, the declaration of human rights and citizenship, that's the event, the gospel of France. And that truth must be known in all the departments. But our leaders established a military government. The government in Haiti is a military government, which is based on violence against the people and respect for the great powers. We cannot be nice with Asian state. Thank you.
Thank you, Beatrice. This is a great opening for the Peace on Dictatorship in half an hour. So we have a half hour break, and Thank you very much for your attention and for your presence. See you in a bit.